Last time I spoke here was pre-COVID, so that gives you some time frame. At that point in time, you did not see any of this stuff. This actually got, with our social distancing, I socially distanced my razor, and it went out the window. And here we are, looking for a Santa Claus job. Valentine's Day, 2021, February 14th, of course. Little brief trivia as we get started into this Valentine's Day. Where did it come from? Do you ever ask yourself that question? By doing some research on it, you'll find all kinds of answers. Bottom line is, nobody really knows for sure how it got started. Many, 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 many years ago, evidently there was a priest and up to as many as three with the name of Valentine. They would try to associate these men with different activities that somehow brought this about, but evidently they were all martyred in one manner or another. One of them was said that he was thrown into prison because he refused to obey Roman orders to not marry loved ones. The Roman army did not want these young men that they wanted to bring into the army married. This priest refused to do that, therefore he was thrown into prison. And some kind of a relationship developed between one of the guards and Mr. Valentine, and he had written a letter to this individual, and he signed it, "Your Valentine." So you can take that and you can kind of roll it into the history of the church and things, and it has been changed down through the years several times as to what this is to be. For a long time, back in the 1800s, it was a day of more of a time of remembering your loved ones. And the idea was just to simply write letters or notes to them, to remind them that you still are thinking of them, letting them know of your love for them, those kind of things. As time progressed, as we got towards into the 20th century, paper became cheaper. The printing process was much more developed, and several companies got involved in capitalizing on this Valentine's Day thing. One of those was Hallmark in 1911. Things went ballistic from then. Things got changed a lot in the aspect of what or how this day would be celebrated. Many different things you'll see out there. The commercialization has went rampant. Every year it seems to get more so. If any of you have been in any of the stores in the last few days, you will see everything imaginable somehow connected to Valentine's Day. You turn on a TV ad or anywhere, it's there. You will find that they promote the fact that if you give a gift, it's much, much better for your love situation. The greater the gift, the better your love evidently is being displayed. And to your spouse, the more unique it is and the greater it is, and it somehow socially is received as you really, really love this person. Best one I heard this last month was driving down the highway on the radio, and on comes an ad from a local vendor, and it said that in their opinion, the absolute best gift that you can give your loved one this Valentine's Day is a new gun. And I'm thinking, you better evaluate your relationship before you do that. If anything, don't give them any ammunition, okay? But you can't buy that now anyway, so it's hard to buy. So I thought, wow, we have gone a long ways in this commercialization. When I was young, Valentines were exchanged in the classroom at school. It was something they looked forward to, of course, with great fanfare. They talked about it a lot, and the aspect was mounted around that everyone needed to receive these. Everyone would create some kind of a little drop box, and I think they still do that with your name on it. The teacher would hand out a list of everybody's names so that no one was overlooked. They would want everyone to receive Valentines. But lo and behold, it seemed like every year there was a two or three people that got a whole lot more than others. And that's kind of where stuffing the ballot box, I think, kind of came into play. Because it was always those same ones. And the interesting part of it was they seemed to somehow elevate themselves a little bit of the look at me, I am loved more than any of the rest of you. You understand what I'm saying? And I view it a lot like, in that situation, how we treat in social media today, isn't it? When you make an entry or make a note or post a picture, you automatically, you're drawn to see how many likes you get. for some people, that's a big deal, right? We somehow equate our value and our worth as to how many people respond and show their approval of either us, what we said, or what we posted. And if we don't get many of those, we kind of get bummed out. Am I wrong? No, I don't think so. We have reevaluated how we value ourselves by what the society feeds back to us. It's a whole different thing, and it's in a way, it's not a healthy thing, I believe, because we can get wrapped up in it. How many people, how many friends do you have on Facebook? The more friends you have, you must be of greater worth and value. I think we're being misled as to what the value of us is. We're looking to the wrong sources to evaluate our value. The messages within the cards that we received when I was younger, the simple ones, especially the kids, you know, be my Valentine. Well, we had no clue what that meant. We were that big. Or be my friend, or be my best friend forever. Those kind of things, you know, we get a lot of cards. Well, to now today, from what I see from my grandkids, kind of their own cars, I think Hallmark's losing out because 98% of what came in their box was candy. The candy manufacturers have taken over Valentine's Day. And in their wrappers, they put little hearts and it says to and from and all this stuff to somehow get away from the actual message of love. Here, fatten yourself up. Give your kids a sugar high. Their parents will like you for that. You don't wound up, you know. But it was different back in the day. Now, you've probably guessed I am no spring chicken. Been around a while, and things have changed. I've seen a lot of change, and especially in the things of how we view ourselves. And I'm going to touch on that this morning. And, of course, being how it's Valentine's Day, we're going to focus on a big word there, and that's love. We're going to talk about that. Are you still getting the feedback? So. The word love, and we're going to look at another word. It's called integrity. And the third word I'm going to look at is covenant. And some of those are going to be wrapped together. We're going to see how all those things complement each other. And without one of those components in there, things start to degrade. They start to fall apart. The word love, as I begin is view it as I watch things and I learn through these years, this word love has become abused and misused. So what do I mean by that? How do we use this love? The word love has become a common adjective. It shows a very strong liking or attraction to something if you try to analyze how it's being used. For example, I love to travel. I love to go hiking. I really love to dance. Or how about, I really love McDonald's French fries. You see where I'm going with that? We use a word that is so special and so set apart by God, and we've evolved it into a different application. And I think it becomes confusing to people, especially young people, what this word really means. Falling in love. It seems to be a prerequisite for any kind of a relationship as far as boys and girls things, for it to progress. How does that work? So I started jotting down things, just how things happen. Now, a lot of these things I want you to know, I'm going to speak about today, and I should add this now. I am not speaking directly to anyone by what I know of their situation or any of the rest of it. It's in general in society, but some of these I've actually experienced myself. How does this love happen? It's a reason to marry. Boy meets girl. Could be an invitation to meet, a common attraction or a chance meeting. It could be initiated from a simple Valentine as we have today. A sort of a notice that there's an interest in it. So the boy asks the girl for a date. Boy really likes girl, has to go steady. Boy really likes girl and falls in love. Boy asks girl to marry. Girl thinks about it, decides he must ask her father for permission. Boy asks her dad if he can marry his daughter. Dad asks the boy, why do you want to marry my daughter? voice says, because we're in love. Dad asks the boy, how do you know you're in love? Boy responds, well, she's really nice. And she's pretty. And she's very kind to people. And she's really pretty. She's very spiritual, you know. We see her in church. She's very beautiful. See where I'm going with this? That's why we're in love. So the dad gives us permission. The boy asks the girl to marry, and then she must make a decision to decide if she is in love, and she says yes, or if she will decide if she's not in love and say no. Unless he has a lot of money. What is this kind of love experience? Where does it spark from? When you're together, you find yourself together, especially young people. Maybe I should do this before. Is there any young people in here, like teenagers? Raise your hand. Friendly relatives. Okay. I'm going to talk about something here, and then when I get to it, I want you to like hold your hand over your ears. I don't think you should hear this. Because your mama, who is probably sitting close to you, don't want you to hear this. Maybe your dad as well. So you will know when I get to the part where I don't want you to hear it, because it'll be that point where I'm talking about where I met my wife, and she was 16 and I was 18. So I don't want you to get any crazy notions. So okay, just hold your hand. But that it'll be reality. When you come together, especially at our age, at 16 and 18, okay, you find yourself in kind of a whirlwind, a tizzy. Things are different, suddenly changed. I was a very studious young man. I had very high grades in school. I was focused and concentrated on my work after school. I was into airplanes and stuff. I had no real ambitions outside of that. But when I was introduced or asked to meet this young lady, and oh, by the way, that was nearly 50 years ago, and the gal that introduced us is sitting right next to me. They were best friends in school. Her boyfriend at the time was my best friend, and so she brought us together. And when almost from the start, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, it's just something special, and it's kind of like, wow, this is new, this is cool stuff. And you find yourself constantly wanting to be together. You're always thinking about ways that you can get together, and even if you have to kind of maybe fudge the reason you got to drive into town to the grocery store, maybe go by your girlfriend's house or something. You want to reach out and touch them or just simply brush by them and maybe hold hands at times. Even in the old days, back where I was at, you sent these things we called letters. A piece of paper, and you write something down, and you pick up the phone if mom lets you talk on the line for 2 minutes, maybe at max. Nowadays we have texting. So those are the things that we would do. Being together became our primary focus, and all other activities became less important and typically suffered. My schoolwork suffered. My senior year of high school, last part of it, I'm going into what we call college algebra, it was calculus. And I'll tell you what, my mind wasn't calculus. And I went from an A student to barely slide through the class. I just went into it. My mind was elsewhere, it was out the window. So these feelings, it's hard to put a name to what's happening in your life. Things are totally weird and strange. And the nearest thing we can come up with for a description of what these things are is a word we hear, it's, I guess, love. So surely, I must be in love. That's what we thought. And I still think we were. This type of love, if it leads to marriage, though, can be somewhat interesting. There may have been something missing in a lot of young people's relationships in this love thing, of a component that is commonly left out. If it stopped right where we were at and individuals go on and marry from that point, they're on shaky ground. if you get married and you link your life together with someone that is built on merely the aspect of perhaps this emotional feeling of good looks, guess what? That's going to change. If it's based on perhaps a social status or prospect of a secure future, that can also change too. Life will get in the way. Dirty clothes, messy houses, bills, bill collectors, that strong, muscular, handsome body he had suddenly sliding south and gathering around his waistline. The toothpaste might get squeezed from the middle and the toilet seat left up. You hear that scream in the middle of the night. And that's where the fight started. The months last longer than the checkbook. Finances get shortened and the blame game begins. It may have been about a fancy wedding. As we, you know what, it's interesting, as we get into these situations, and as I understand it, and I've watched it a lot, there's no way to do it. They start talking about marriage and romance and of the big wedding, the lavish get together of everyone and all the expense on the problem. If that's your main focus on why you're getting married is a ceremony like that, you might be on shaky ground. I was shook up a few months ago or a year. To go against now on the North Slope. I was listening to two young guys talking about this aspect, and the one young man was going to get married in just a couple of weeks, and they were talking about, and he was showing a picture of his bride-to-be. And then he made the comment to him, he says, yeah, here's my start of life. And that's it. Chills in my spine thinking about that. Where have we come to in our society? The idea or concept of getting married to someone and it's going to be just a starter life, like buying your first home. And you figure in the onset that this is destined to fail. Why would you go into that? That is so foolish. There's something extremely missing. Yvette and I think in our success was partly due to because as children in high school, she was 16, I was 18. She was a sophomore, crying out loud. I was barely a senior. But we had one thing going for us that made it succeed. We knew everything. We had it figured out. What do those old guys know? We got this, I got a Mustang, it's paid for, got a job, fucking a half an hour after school. Maybe we should wait. And quite honestly, that was tempted. She said, why don't we just elope? Let's go get married. I'll drop out of school or I'll go to school online. And I said, no. I was smart enough to realize we needed to have our ducks in a row. And the agreement then was, this was an agreement. Yvette, you must graduate. You must complete high school. And I am going off to a trade school and get my aircraft and mechanic certifications. I needed that. That was my future. I planned on for my profession. And we agreed in a covenant that if this is to be, if we're to be married, those things had to happen. And we did. We stuck to it. And I did ask her dad, sitting in a pickup in front of her house one night, if I could marry her. And he's sitting there looking at me, and I'm asking him if I could marry his 16-year-old daughter. And I'm 18, and I was walking on the water, I tell you. That was scary, because I didn't know how we would go for that. But then he again asked us, why do you want to do this? And we put a lot of things. But then we explained, well, we're going to wait a couple of years till we get out of school. And I think that, as I recall, and he never could convert it. That's what I remember in the conversation. I think it was at ease at that point. He said, okay, that's cool. Probably thinking that 2 years' time, they'll get over it. They'll get over it. Love, what is it? What does the Bible say about love? Let's get into that. 1 John 4, verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another. For love is from God. Whoever loves and has been born of God and knows God Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love is perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in him and he in us, because he has given us his Spirit. And we have seen and testify that the Father has sent his Son to be Savior of the world. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him, and he in God. We go on, but it continues on into it. Paul in Corinthians 13, it talks about it, and he tries to describe what this kind of love really is, what love should be about. Not the one that I started out with. He says, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Does any of this description fit the kind of love that I thought I had? Did I suddenly fall into patience? Not hardly. No. Was I suddenly not envious? No. Was I suddenly not arrogant? No. To use the common vernacular of the day in the 1970s, it wasn't love. We were simply turned on. We got turned on by each other. We were excited about each other. It wasn't necessarily true love. But it's a component of love. It's a component of it. Did you know, at least to best of my knowledge, that love is not a prerequisite for marriage in Scripture? It's not a prerequisite. Even from the beginning of time in Genesis. Genesis chapter 2, verse 21 to 25. Then the man said, this is at last is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. And God says, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So the man and his wife are both naked and were not ashamed. Notice he said, shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife. Hold fast. Never let go. Hold tight. Malachi, the prophet, the last book of the Old Testament, had this to say about it. And it was a period of discussion there, and he was actually chastising for some improprieties. But he said this in chapter 2, verse 14. But you say, why does he not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. She is your wife by covenant. She didn't say anything about love. Covenant. The great thing to have compassionate love, of course, and something else is always needed to be there. That thing is commitment. A covenant is a binding agreement before God. Both parties are involved and expected to follow the rules of the agreement. How well you fulfill that covenant depends on one thing, and that's how much integrity you possess. Now, everyone has a certain amount of integrity, and if you choose to apply it only in specific areas and not in others, that's poor integrity, poor. But the amount of integrity that you protect, you obtain, or hold, is what is going to make it work. Integrity. How did that work for me at 18 years old? She's 16. I clearly recall dropping Yvette off at her home one night after we'd been out sat back in my car and I watched her walk into her home, and I suddenly said to myself, that is the girl I'm going to marry. And at that point in time, I determined myself that that would be so. And from my background and my parents, my grandparents, marriage to them was forever. One-time deal. And so in my determination, I realized in my mind I would be with her forever. And not going to let anything else stand up. I believe that was the key. Because as we separated for those 2 years, and over time and space, all we had together was the letters. I think in those last 2 years, I saw her just 3 or 4 weeks out of the whole 2 years. At the end of that time span, when our agreement was come together and was completed, we came together. And it all started. 9/11/1973. This year will be 48 years together. I think we're almost an extinct tiny animal here. 48 years. Coming up. We were poor as church mice. We had really nothing. We just had each other. We scraped together. We got a $28 gold band, and that's what's on her finger. I saw it this morning. Same one. I couldn't even afford one for myself. But in my profession, I couldn't have worn it much anyway. Is that going to bond our marriage together, the ring on the finger, to make sure it lasted? What is the commitment? Young ones, if and when you ponder the aspect of marriage, you must determine that you're going to love that individual with everything. I'm going to talk to you in a minute what that really, in my mind, entails. It's critical. True, genuine, lasting love is founded upon a volitional decision to love your spouse. And that is to put their needs ahead of your own. To accomplish this requires a thing called integrity, a determination to fulfill that commitment to love. What is volitional? Now, some of you may not totally understand the term, what I mean by volitional. As an illustration, the lady got up and left the room of her own volition. No one forced her to do it. Nobody's holding a gun on her. There's five buildings not on fire or anything else. She determined in her mind to leave. She got up and left of her own volition. No outward force causing that to be done. In putting your spouse's needs ahead of your own, for example, in this relationship, you commit to that. If your wife or your husband asks you to get up and close the window, if you want it open, you get up and close it anyway. And your wife, being of like mind, also considering your needs and desires, may say, well, let's just close it halfway. See what I'm saying? It's a two-way street, and when it works that way, it's going to have a much more harmonious outcome. And put their needs ahead of your own. What is a covenant? The covenant is a promise, and it's almost a contract. It's only as good as the integrity and the trustworthiness of all individuals involved. Being found faithful and trustworthy is precious in God's sight. Proverbs 12:22. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who act faithfully are his delight. Proverbs 21:3. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Proverbs 4:25. Let your eyes look directly forward and your gaze be straight before you. Ponder the path of your feet and then all your ways will be sure. Do not swerve to the right or to the left. Turn your foot away from evil. And in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 and 9, it says, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things. And the God of peace will be with you." To be a faithful and trustworthy person is of the very highest regard. No matter what your job is, where you live, your skill level, your place in society, it is the most precious thing. It is hard gained and easily lost. Hard gained and easily lost. To maintain your integrity, you must guard your thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Guard your thoughts. It's the correct, direct link to maintaining integrity. Your thoughts become words. Your words become actions. Your actions become deeds. And your deeds become words. Read it again. Thought becomes words. Words become actions. Actions become deeds. Your deeds become your legacy. Guard your thoughts. Show respect even in your thoughts. What do I mean by that? Guys, speaking to you now. If you see a very attractive young lady walking down the street, what goes through your mind? Does the thought come through, boy, she's a foxy looking baby. Cute chick. Perhaps you should say, "Oh my, that's a very lovely lady." When we do that, you have suddenly shifted from desire to respect. In the same token, applies to ladies. And you see some good looking hunk. Very nice gentleman. Don't let it slide into lust or desire. Place it in a position of respect. And it's amazing when you do that, your mind and your thought pattern suddenly shifts. Be trustworthy and your word is everything. Your word should be your bond, not words copied on some piece of paper. When you give your word, make a promise, make a deal, you stick to it. I hope this doesn't offend you, but as the old timer said, come hell or high water, stick to it. When you make a promise, you stick to it. When your boss says, "I need you here at 7 o'clock, and you say, "Okay, be there at 7. Actually, 10 minutes earlier, 15. If you can't comply with what they ask, don't agree. Don't promise something you can't fulfill. We all have limitations. If you recognize a weakness in yourself to fulfill an act that they want you to do, you need to admit it. Say, "I'm sorry, I'll try. I'll try to get there at 7. The car's pretty shaky right now. I'm not sure. Might get stuck in the car." Those kind of things. But if you say, "I will," you need to be there. So how are we doing on integrity in the nation? Let me get to that. I want to talk a little more about reputation first. I grew up in Southern Colorado, an area of what was once considered the Old West, if you will. Cowboy, Indian type stuff, all that, the ranchers. I grew up in cattle country, farming and ranching in the valleys. In the 1800s, at least, and through centuries before that, a man's reputation was everything. And in the era where I was at, it still was prevalent, but especially in the 1800s, as the country was being settled and people moved west. A man's good reputation was vital to be able to function properly in society. A man's word was his bond. Huge deals was made simply on a man's word and nothing else. Cattle were bought and sold regularly on this basis. If a man delivered a herd of cattle and said it was 500 head, and if they were in good shape, he got paid. But there better be 500 head. If the count wasn't right, then that man's word could no longer be trusted. And then his ability to buy and sell on that basis was severely impaired. The quickest way to get in a fight was to challenge someone's credibility. To call him a liar or a cheat was often met with violence. Many men were killed or injured for this in gun battles or fistfights. A man's word could not be slandered without a response. Otherwise, people would think that the accusations were true and would no longer trust him. His credit would be cut off. People were very careful about the language they used. This is one of the reasons that I believe divorce was harshly looked on upon in those days. And even well into the middle of the last century. If a man or woman divorced, it was assumed that someone had broken the sacred vows of marriage. Their covenant was shattered. Their word and faithfulness was in question. They were sometimes shunned or even worse, and at times needed to move away just to start over. A man's word was everything. It didn't need to be written down by a contractor, drawn up by an attorney. This trend was still evident as late as into the 1950s and 60s. When a new thing arrived, and after the Vietnam Wars, the free love movement seemed to take hold. Marriage didn't appear to hold a sacred bond as it once did, and a moral decline was obvious. The end began to justify the means, especially in personal satisfaction and often in business. If it feels good, do it. You ever heard that phrase? It feels good, do it. So integrity is the measure of a man. You are either a good person or you are no good. Not just in marriage, but in all aspects of life. You get the point feeling that I'm serious about this? You need to make a volitional decision to commit to what you say. Is it easy? No. And it seldom is. Temptations will try to pull you away. In marriage, it's another man or woman. It could be pornography. It could be hanging out with the wrong people. Or simply watching the wrong type of TV program, such as soap operas, where everybody's cheating on somebody. And if you absorb that kind of junk long enough, you begin to think that maybe your spouse is. Be careful what you allow. In business, it's greed. More money's made at all costs. Your marriage must be guarded, and it takes work. For example, Billy Graham, one of the most highly thought of and respected men in our country in our time. A major decision was made by Mr. Graham. So he and his associates were concerned about trying to avoid pitfalls and scandals that seemed to plague the evangelistic ministries. Things would happen and things would just fall apart. They wanted to avoid that. Dr. Graham and three of his associates met in a motel in Modesto, California to revise the reputation of evangelists of the day. The group decided that sexual immorality, pride, and greed were the three greatest vices that evangelists would fall prey to. And it was there that the Modesto Manifesto was birthed. The group agreed first that they would never be alone with a woman who was not their wife. Never be alone with a woman that's not your wife. It's the good advice. His staff would search the hotel room every night to verify that no woman was hiding in his room. Second, they decided not to touch the money. They would have their offerings received and counted by local leadership, and they would all simply take a salary. Third, they would not overstate the results evangelistically speaking. Numbers were flying everywhere of attendance in meetings, and they would only state the exact number present. And they said that they would never criticize other leaders from the pulpit. Using the pulpit to elbow pastor competitors is not the will of God. Bear with me for a moment as I regress a little bit about Yvette and I and this love that we have. As we came together in 1973, we had all figured out how things would go. How to maintain the aircraft industry, so on and so forth. To make a long story short, we moved back to our hometown. I was self-employed before I was 21 years old, working on aircraft. You can imagine that some young kid working here. And we moved in there. Was it easy? Not so much. Didn't have a lot. We lived in a $40 a month shack near the airport. That was utilities included, by the way. A small former Air Force latrine converted into a house with mice running up and down the walls. And some of those times were the most happiest we had. Until after 4 years, and she decided she had enough mice, we moved elsewhere. But to expand the story on out into later in 1981, something started to happen to my love of my life. Something that led to the second greatest love of mice. For whatever reason, we still don't know, over a period of time, quite a bit of time, she started to become ill. Losing her ability to feel and to touch, she could burn her hands real easy. She hard to maintain her balance and stability. She would fall down at a sudden notice. She had to quit work. And as it progressed even further, it got to where she couldn't even walk. And I remember pushing her through a mall, Pueblo, Colorado, Christmas shopping, and she was in a wheelchair. That wasn't in the plan. It wasn't in the plan for her life. Later on, it progressed even worse to the point that Yvette was totally paralyzed from the neck down. She couldn't take care of herself, and I took a crash course in caring for an invalid. That's not fun. That's not what I had in mind for what the future would bring. One night, while I was there taking care of her by myself, she got my attention, and it got scary because she was having trouble breathing. She couldn't move. She was in pain. So I called some friends on the fire department. I was a member there. We got the ambulance, loaded her up, headed to her hospital, which is 18 miles away in Oaxaca, Colorado. On the way in that ambulance, I thought she was dying because she wasn't breathing. I got oxygen on to her. I was right there beside her. And by the time we got to the hospital, she regained consciousness. We got her into the hospital and hooked up all the hoses and wires and connections. You know what it is. Trying to figure out what was going on with the intensive type thing. Got her into the room there and started running test after test. And we had been in hospitals and clinics and everything all around, trying to sort this out and understand it, but they could never find an answer. And the doctors were struggling at the same time, trying to find this answer, and they couldn't do it. I spent one 48-hour stretch in that hospital with her, and that's all you could do. And I had to go get some sleep finally. We were, you know, at this point, just hoping the doctors would come up with something and find a reason that they could treat her. They couldn't. I went home, and that night, walked into a dark living room in my home 20 miles away, and I sat down in a chair, and for the first time in my life, I said a prayer and meant it. I knew like a church. I was not raised that way. Sundays and weekends, that was my time, not God's time. And for the first time in my life, I sat down in a chair and said a prayer. And that was simply, God, I don't know who you are or what you can do, but would you just please help her? And that was it. The next morning, I couldn't stay away, and I was back up there early the next morning with her. And at 10 o'clock, we had some visitors stop by. And it turned out it was the pastor at the local Baptist Church, and all the town, some friends that attended there asked if they could see us, and they did. Man and wife, John and Pam Wilson. We had a cordial visit, you know, typical stuff. But when they got ready to leave, he asked, "Can I pray for you guys?" And I said, "Man, go for it. Nothing else has worked. Maybe that will." And so he did. He prayed, and his prayer, as I can recall, the best I can, he asked, "Lord, would you just please gift the doctors that they could find and discover what's troubling her and so they could treat it and bring her back to health," and so on and so forth. But then he concluded it by saying, "My God, if that's not your will or direction, would you just please simply heal her? Heal her." And they left. 10 o'clock in the morning, they showed up in the 1 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody else showed up. It was God. I still get emotional thinking about it. You hear me? I'm sitting there watching TV, killing time, and she got my attention, and I looked over, and she was beginning to move her ankles. Then she started to bend her knees. And suddenly everything was working. 15-minute time span, the paralyzation had been down for so long. Gone.
Here's the Lord.
I got on the buzzer, called the doctors in, they walked in, and the nurses were jaw dropped. Here's the thing. They were sure she was dying. They couldn't stop it. Her mother's an RN. She felt that she was dying as well. My mom was an RN, and that's how we got through a lot of this. She was certain that that's what was going to happen. And yet, a miracle. But I was too dumb to realize it. I'm a stubborn sort of Irishman. I want to know if we're dealing with something that's going to come and go, what is it? So I took her from there. 10 days later, by the way, she walked out of the hospital. She had to learn how to walk again. I took her from there to Pueblo, Colorado, to Parkview Medical Center, and had to run more tests, trying to figure out what this was. Came back negative. I took her from there to the CU Medical Center in Denver, Colorado, the best hospital in the state. In that sequence of events, she saw over 18 different specialists. And in the end of it all, they had a big meeting with us, and they says, "We recognize you experienced very real symptoms, but we don't know what caused it. And furthermore, we don't know what cured it. Have a nice day." We walked out of that hospital, and she did not set foot in the hospital again until 3 years later, give birth to a 9-pound baby boy. Thank you. It took some time, and it took some friends sharing things about this miracle that I had seen, and to understand the realization that God did answer our prayers. He did show up, and he proved to me at that point in time, he's real. He's not something imaginary written about in a fairy tale, a fable book. He showed up that day, and I saw it. I saw his word. And that proved to me that he knows what's going on in the lines. He cares. He hears us. He knows what's going on with every single one of you. He knows your struggles. He knows your heartache. He knows your pain. Don't think he doesn't care. You don't need to give a Valentine from him to prove that he cares. But he does. Changed their life. And we fell in love with him. You don't need a Valentine to prove that he cares. But since it was Valentine's Day and I was sitting there trying to think through this, what can I share that shows his love? What did it say on Valentine's? He used to write letters and to get messages across about how much they miss each other in his Valentine efforts. So I got thinking about it. What would God possibly put in a Valentine to us. So I started jotting this down, and I thought about some things. So bear with me as I read my thoughts to you. I'll preface it by this. God in the scripture in Revelation 3:20 says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him and he with me." He wants to meet us on our ground. If God were to send you a Valentine this day or slip it under the door that you haven't answered, what might it say? "Dearest beloved, I know that you seldom think of me in your busy life and your hectic schedules, but I want you to know that I miss you so much. I want to share in your life even as busy as it is. When you struggle, I want to be there to defend you. When you cry, I want to be allowed to comfort you. When you fall, I want to be there to pick you up, to strengthen you, so that you can carry on. And there are so many great things that I want to share with you, so many that you cannot even begin to imagine. But beloved, you need to know this. Long ago, before you even realized that I existed, I knew you. I realized that our being together as things are would be impossible, that my son and I determined that a way would be found. I can tell you this much. It was painful, extremely difficult, and a great price was extracted. But you must know that my love for you is so great that it was all worthwhile. To keep busy, I'm building this really big house. It's a special place. I think you will like it. I fixed a room just special for you. When everything is ready and the right time, my son Jesus will come and get you. That is, if you really want to. You do need to speak to him about this. Until then, my son, Jesus is ready and he's willing to help you along the way. So please remember, if you ever need a friend closer than your brother, try Jesus. If you ever need a counselor better than your mother, try Jesus. If you ever need someone to draw you closer to the Father, try Jesus. If you ever need a hand to help you step out onto the water, try Jesus. He alone knows your condition. He alone knows your heart's intention. If you ever need someone to lay down their life for you, try Jesus. If you ever need a healer, when the doctor walks away, friend, try Jesus. And if you never thought you'd have the strength to face another day, try Jesus. If you ever needed someone to walk with you to the end, try my Jesus. And if you ever need to hear the words, "I forgive you," try Jesus. Until we meet, remember, I love you. Be mine. Christ has given us a picture of what the greatest kind of love looks like. We find it in John 3:16. It was a decision to love, though we were not lovable, and we were in fact enemies. It's a volitional decision of his. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And in John 14, verses 1 through 7, Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I would have told you that I go and prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again. And I will take you unto myself, so that where I am, you may be also. The promise.
That's a covenant.
And it's sealed by his blood. Then Jesus quoted one of the most important commandments in Mark chapter 12, verse 28. One of the scribes came up and heard him disputing with another, and seeing that he answered him well, he asked him, "What commandment is the most important of all?" Jesus answered, "The most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, that you should love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." It's all about love. How do you do that? How can you love God when you can't really see with everything? Your heart, mind, soul, and strength. How do you do that? It seems impossible. And if the only kind of love you can manifest is the emotional stuff that we've talked about, how can you share that to him? You can have some of that, but you do it the same way that you are to love your spouse, with a volitional decision to put the Lord's desires ahead of your own. And that applies in life and in marriage. Decision. Put his needs, his desires ahead of your own. That's what it means to love him with everything. You do this and then you trust him. Sounds hard. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 and 6, one of my favorites, first one I ever memorized. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your path. He will guide you. At my age now, just after 68 years of being on this earth, and 40-some almost, and being a child of his, I have the benefit of hindsight, folks. And I see how he's directed paths in my life, and directs paths in an amazing way. And you can apply the what-ifs to each of these events all through your life. I'm glad he took his word. If he had not, I would not be standing here today. I guarantee you that. If he hadn't shown up in that hospital room, we'd probably both be dead. We'd be here. It's a very special day. I'd ask MJ to play a special song I want to close with this morning. Think back when you first fell in love, or even along the way, as that changed and manifested itself, you would dream and look forward to the future of how that might look, what it might be. And I have a very strong source that has told me, by the way, it's my wife. She says that young girls, by the time they had their second or third date with an individual, is usually trying on his name. By the fourth or fifth time, they're already picking names out for kids. They're dreaming, they're imagining, what will it be like? What will it be like? I asked MJ to play a song that's called "I Can Only Imagine." What I'd like you to focus on this morning as we close. You remember falling in love, the thoughts it was like. But what will it be like when you see Jesus? Please listen and examine yourself. Don't sing along. I want you to just listen this morning. Maybe close your eyes and just contemplate. You can stand up, you can worship however you want to. But it's about him. And if you're a child of his, if you've received him as your Lord and Savior, he has promised it us by covenant that he will take us there. There's no greater want of integrity in God than this in Jesus. But you must ask yourself, will I be there? Have you trusted him as your Lord and Savior? Jesus said someday he'll come and gather his bride, and those who have received him as Lord and Savior will be lifted up. If we don't go home to him first, he says he's coming back. He's going to take all those, but his bride is going to receive them. Would you be going with him? Or would you be left behind? That's a question you must ask yourself. If there's something on your mind today, if something's been troubling you, if you need to change things, a recommitment perhaps. And again, integrity is our greatest desire, but sometimes we fall short. Probably a whole lot more than we would want to. Things get in the way. And if your promise and commitments are a little bit on the weak side, perhaps it's a time to recommit to those things. It can be between you and your spouse or to your Lord. If you've never trusted him as your Savior, strongly encourage you to do that. As she plays, if you want to, you can slip out, come down here. We'll set out with you and show you from the scriptures how it shows how you can know absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt that when you die, you will be with him. If you need to pray, if there's something on your heart that you need to just someone to come alongside, you do that. Do that this morning. Want to be a member of this church, you can come ahead. We'll talk to you about that. If baptism is on your heart, if you need to take care of that, by all means, come forward and let us know. Whilst he plays.